Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll look at a number of subjects in the news. We'll begin in a moment and speak with Marcia Friedman, who's a former member of the Israeli Knesset, and we'll be talking to her about Ariel Sharon's stroke, his exit from Israeli politics at a critical moment, and we'll look into what might be happening in terms of the Israeli-Palestinian peace process as a result of this vacuum of power. And we'll also speak with Ari Berman, who's a contributing writer to The Nation magazine. He's been covering the Abramoff scandal for The Nation magazine. We'll be speaking to him about the political fallout as Tom DeLay's K Street project crumbles along with DeLay's political career. And we'll also talk with Dr. Craig Holman, who's the legislative representative for Public Citizen, serving as that organization's Capitol Hill lobbyist on campaign financing and government ethics. Dr. Holman has assisted in drafting campaign finance reform legislation and has conducted numerous research projects on the initiative process and the impact of money in politics. We'll be talking to him about his belief that the defective structure of the system in American politics is what enables corruption. Let's now go to the subject of the incapacity of Ariel Sharon and how it may affect the Israeli-Palestinian peace process. I'm speaking with Marcia Friedman, who's a former member of the Israeli Knesset and the president of the Jewish Alliance for Justice and Peace. And obviously you've been following events in Israel closely. Of course, there have been momentous events in the last year or so with Gaza pullout, the split within the Likud party, then the abandonment of the party that he helped create by Ariel Sharon. And now this debilitating stroke. On Monday, they will take him out of his medically induced coma, but the general consensus is that his political career is over. What's your feelings, Marcia, about his successor? Think that he's up to the task?
Are you talking about Ehud Olmert?
Ehud Olmert, yes.
It's not very clear that he is the successor. I mean, the truth is that Sharon has always played his cards very close to his chest, and I don't think anybody quite knows even what his particular endgame vision was for the new Kadima party and how he exactly wanted to see this final resolution of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. I would say, as far as I'm concerned, everything is quite up in the air right now in Israel, in Israeli politics, that is to say. The system will function. The system is functioning. It's solid enough for that, too, for its various institutions of state and government to continue to function. What is the difficult part right now is that the Kadima party, which was formed only about a month or so ago by Sharon, has no internal party institutions. It hadn't yet chosen a list. It was obviously going to be Sharon individually, personally, who was going to determine the list for the next Knesset. The elections are only 2 months away. It doesn't have a platform. It has nothing. So whether or not they will be able to get themselves together quickly enough and to find enough of a common denominator politically among them without just lining up behind Ariel Sharon to provide the direction for them is a question that I don't think we have the answer to yet, but we will know that in a couple of weeks. Barring that, I suspect that what will happen is that, at least on the labor side, many of, or if not all, of the labor party members who defected from Amir Peretz might just return to the Labor Party, leaving Kadima as a kind of second Likud or a split off from the Likud, and then it would have to be some sort of negotiation to decide whether or not to reunite the Likud and undo what Sharon had done. So again, as I say, whether or not people can pull this off in his absence, something that he himself uniquely had made happen and was to be leading in this very sensitive period of time, is a question that I don't have the answer to, and I don't think anybody can.
Well, Marcia Friedman, obviously the party was a one-man show, and and now that he's no longer viable, it seems. I understand there is a vast vacuum there, but just in terms of the political center, which is what Chiron gravitated towards, there seems to be a lot to work with there, is there not? I mean, you've got the Shinui party, which is basically a secular and centrist.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a lot to work with, and there isn't a lot to work. I mean, the tension here in what we're calling the center, and this is definitely the political center. It's the center-right and center-left that Chiron has united, both in terms of elected officials as well as voters. And that's a very important thing. The tension within that center is whether or not to resolve the conflict with the Palestinians by unilateral moves or to move towards a negotiated resolution. The Labour Party is on record as supporting negotiations. Chiron is on record pretty much as supporting unilateral moves. And it's not clear where I don't think the Israeli public cares one way or the other, but it does make a huge difference. And the difference is, if there is not a negotiated resolution, then in fact the Israelis have drawn their own borders and have in fact drawn the borders of Palestine in ways that one can assume will be to the benefit of the Israelis and to the detriment of the Palestinians. And the conflict will not be resolved. Those borders will never be quiet borders and so on. So, but as I say, that center is not defined, and it was being left to Sharon to define it. And he, in his usual way, was being very cagey and playing time as it played itself out. So I'm not quite sure that center is a real one.
But in terms of the left, with Amir Peretz, the new leader of the Labour Party, he apparently, from what I understand, his appeal to the electorate is more traditional Labour, left-wing, taking care of the working people in Israel, dealing with the growing gulf between the rich and the poor, which is obviously afflicts this country as well as as Israel. And he doesn't appear to have a great deal of interest in the peace process. Is that a fair reading?
Well, historically, that's definitely not correct. Peretz has been part of the Geneva Initiative negotiation all along. He has been part of the peace camp for decades now and is known as part of the peace camp. One of the unique things about Amir Peretz is that he very clearly perceives the inseparable connection between issues, socioeconomic issues in Israel today, and the peace issue. That without resolving the peace issue, the socioeconomic issues cannot possibly be resolved. That the settlements are draining off an enormous amount of money from social and economic resolution of problems internally in Israel and so on. So Peretz has a great deal to say on that. At the moment, he is being handled, I think, by any number of advisors. And on the other hand, he is a very, very practiced and experienced and shrewd politician. The kind of change that Peretz can make in Israeli society is not one that you're going to see happen in 2 months, however. It's going to take years, and it is going to be a change that is going to be cultural, it's going to be economic, it's going to be sociological, it's going to be ultimately political, but it is going to take time. Peretz is the voice of Israel that has not been heard politically ever in any significant way, and it's enormously significant that he won the leadership of the Labour Party. It will be enormously important, in my mind at least, that he maintain that leadership over the next 4 to 8 years. But he needs to rebuild the Labour Party in the traditional way that you describe, which it hasn't been for at least 20 years.
And he has the potential, I imagine, of peeling off some of the Sephardic votes with the working people in Israel.
He has the potential of peeling it all off.
Away from Likud.
Away from Likud and potentially also from Shas.
I see. So, does Labour face the same problem that the Democratic Party here in the United States faces, both being in flux? The Democrats have to decide in 06 whether they're going to move to the center and try and steal some seats from the Republicans, or return to their traditional more leftist roots. And that's a debate that is beginning. in the Labour, in the Democratic Party here in the United States? What's happening in Israel?
Well, in Israel, I can't tell you exactly from the inside what's happening because I'm not sitting there on the inside. But my guess is that people are coming out of the shock of Sharon's passing so suddenly and so dramatically from the political scene and so unexpectedly. I think that politicians are just beginning to internalize the meaning of that and begin to talk to themselves and one another. And that's true at all of the parties and for all of the personalities involved. I would say that each of them, at this point in time, is wisely looking to the date of March the 28th, because it's definitely, I think that there will definitely be elections. They won't be canceled. It will be important internally and externally to show that the political system continues to work in the absence of a single person. And therefore, they're going to be doing whatever in the short term seems to be the right thing to do to try to get elected. And in that case, if Kadima can pull itself together in any way whatsoever, I think it will be the party that forms the next government, and Peretz will come in respectably but with a minority of the votes this time around, and then have his 4 years' time internally to work on revamping his own party internally. So I don't expect anybody to come out in the next couple of weeks with some brand new kind of a peace initiative that's supposed to take hold in time for the March 28th elections. I think that's not going to happen that way.
Assumption, I guess, is that the Kadima will be headed by Olmert.
That's the way it's looking thus far. It's possible that it could be Peres, but I think that would probably, everybody realizes he's never won an election. That would be a mistake. Olmert, on the other hand, will be the first national leader of the second generation of Israeli politicians, and that's a very big transition for Israelis.
Right. Well, there's been an assumption. Martin Nidnik, the former American ambassador to Israel, mentioned it recently, that this generational shift is quite profound, and mm-hmm. that people of Sharon and Rabin's generation never trusted the younger generation. In particular, Sharon never trusted Netanyahu with the responsibilities of peace. So, what's likely to happen there? I mean, you said earlier, Marcia Friedman, that the choice was either to continue a dialogue and a negotiation with the Palestinians or to act unilaterally. Mm-hmm. The problem seems to be that we're not going to have anybody on the other side if this thing drags out much longer.
Well, we may not have anybody on the other side. We may not have anybody on either side. The Palestinians right now are in their own political hell, I would say. I mean, they're having their major, major, major problems of getting their own parties together and sorted out in order to have an orderly election, and then nobody knows how that election is going to come out and whether or not there'll be a partner for peace in the Palestinian Authority on the other side of it or not. And I think the same is true on the Israeli side. So this is not a period of time looking for any kind of initiatives to resolve the conflict. I think this is the time just sorting out who their leadership is and is going to be in a very fresh way. I mean, in a way, it's encouraging. To me, it's very encouraging that Ariel Sharon is out of the picture, no matter what the immediate future will hold. It leaves open possibilities that had been very, very closed beforehand in terms of how the conflict could be resolved in the next several years, if at all. So we're just in a time of great turmoil and uncertainty and questions, Ian. More questions than answers, I'm afraid.
But in terms of the Palestinian side, mm-hmm. there is a history where it's clear that we're fighting against the clock here, because for the longest time, if you go back to Rabin's assassination, where the major chance for Oslo and for peace working was shattered, and then Peres took over the mantle, and then he ran against Netanyahu, and that was the period where the Iranians, through their surrogates, Hamas and Islamic Jihad, let off a series of bombs and created this new cycle And it seems so clear that on the Palestinian side, the real contest is between the Fatah, the PLO, and the emerging Iranian-backed Hamas and Islamic Jihad. And now you get, from what polling you can get from the West Bank and Gaza, the indications are that Hamas is growing in popularity because they've been delivering services, and the PLO is losing popularity because they're corrupt and feckless.
That's all true, and it's a little bit oversimplified, so I assume you know that. But
yes.
The picture is more complex than that, and I just want to correct you. As far as I know, there's no evidence at all that jihad and Hamas are backed by Iran. Hezbollah in Lebanon definitely is, but we don't have any particular evidence on this other side. I think the thing that I would like to inject here to sort of more complex is that as Hamas moves into participation in the political arena that it stands for elections and so on, what is happening to Hamas is what has happened everywhere around the world when revolutionary groups move into the electoral process. They become more conservative. Moderate, I would say, not conservative. And so already there are high-level officials in Hamas, not outside of Palestine, but within Palestine, the leadership within Palestine. There are officials who are already making noises. Well, it's not inconceivable we might revise our charter and give up, and accept a two-state solution and accept Israel's right to exist. So those are trial balloons being floated in advance of elections. So Hamas is not a constant in this. At this point in time, Hamas, too, is very much in flux. I've been quite sure what the Palestinian Authority will look like with Hamas inside as part of the Palestinian National Legislature.
Well,
it might be that that's a stronger possibility for a negotiated settlement.
Well, just in closing, Marsha Friedman, though, it does seem that in the broader Middle East landscape, events could overtake this faltering Israeli-Palestinian peace process, and the attention of the White House is obviously diverted with Iraq. I don't know whether in Israel there's an understanding. There's a growing, slowly, the American people are beginning to realize that George Bush has actually rewarded Iran and in this complete blunder in Iraq. And we know that Syria is about to fall. It certainly looks that way, with a member of the Assad inner circle now in Paris speaking out against Assad. And so you get the impression that in the broader context, events could change. Syria could have regime change, and Iran is being strengthened. There's no question about it. And did the Israelis recognize Bush's blunder?
In terms of Iraq?
Yes.
I think the Israelis are xenophobic enough to maintain the assumption that what the United States has done in Iraq is good for them because it's neutralized, at least for the time being, an enemy on one of their borders. And I don't think people are seeing too much beyond that. Understandably, in Israel, and I think if you spent any time there, you understand that every day there's a new crisis in the news, every single day. Some of them are bigger crises than others, but there's always new crises internal to the country, and it is very, very self-absorbed in its own news and doesn't really pay a lot of attention to what's going on around it. Obviously, in its own neighborhood, yes, but I think that the Israelis in general are probably still quite pleased with the American policy in Iraq, and they're not quite as worried about Iran as U.S. is. Right now,
well, I guess it's in both countries. It'll take time for the for the realization of how the chips have fallen in an adverse direction. I thank you for joining us in Los Angeles.
Thank you.
Friend.
Okay. Bye.
Bye. Bye. And hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I was just speaking then with Marcia Friedman, who's a former member of the Israeli Knesset, and we were talking to her about the passing of Ariel Sharon from the political scene at a critical moment, and what is likely to happen with the Palestinian-Israeli peace process and the broader changes in the region. I'm now speaking with Ari Berman, who's a contributing writer for The Nation magazine, and he's the Nation Institute's Puffin Foundation Writing Fellow. He's covered the deepening Abramoff scandal for The Nation magazine, and we're going to be speaking here about Tom DeLay's K Street project crumbling along with his political career. Ari, was DeLay successful in basically corralling all of the lobbying money for the Republicans, or is there still equal opportunity graft in Washington?
Hi, and good to be with you. I think that he was successful in corralling power, in using K Street and big business to marshal support for the Republican Party, and then in turn to give back favors through legislation, through a whole number of things, back to K Street in the business community. But I think what we're seeing is the effects of that, which is more and more indictments, more and more problems. Tom DeLay, of course, is out in the leadership, and everything he's doing is coming out in the open. So in a sense, what we're seeing is the culmination of everything DeLay did spilling forth onto the front page finally.
Well, it seems to be starting to broaden a little bit. We've heard the name of Representative Ney from Ohio, who's apparently quite vulnerable. And in fact, he may even do time in jail. And also the Senator Baucus and Montana, Conrad Burns. And now the LA Times is reporting today that that Pombo and Doolittle, two rural Californian congresspeople, apparently with DeLay's help intervened to stop the feds from fining Hurwitz, a Texas a billionaire who had bought the last of the rainforests up in Northern California and was going to log them. And apparently his savings alone took the taxpayer down for $1.6 billion, and the feds were going to try and extract $300 million out of him, and Pombo and Doolittle intervened on behalf of this rainforest slash and burner. So I get the impression here that we're going to start hearing more and more about some of the rest of the Republicans at the trough.
Well, absolutely, and I think right now Washington is somewhat abuzz thinking about just how many lawmakers will be implicated. Right now, it seems to be, I'd say, roughly half a dozen to a dozen people are being looked at, apparently, according to the Justice Department, in terms of leaks that are coming out. I think, for example, Bob Ney, I think, is done. He's either going to lose his reelection campaign, or more likely, he's going to be indicted and then asked to step down. But I think if you look at the plea of Michael Scanlon, who was Abramoff's partner, and if you look at Abramoff's own plea agreement, they over and over and over and over again cite Representative Number One, who, of course, is Bob Ney. Pombo and Doolittle have been known to people that have been following this scandal sort of under the radar. Pombo's wife was a lobbyist who I think was on the Abramoff payroll. Doolittle had also done favors for Abramoff. So the story today is a big deal that the LA Times broke. But Pombo and Doolittle were in trouble from the beginning. And what we're going to see is people that didn't have any name recognition. Remember, no one knew who Duke Cunningham was a year or two ago either. Suddenly are going to become familiar names that we're going to be hearing more and more about. And if I'm Pombo or Doolittle and a whole number of people, Conrad Burns of Montana, for example, I'm quite worried right now.
Well, it's pretty amazing that nobody noticed Randy Duke Cunningham driving from his yacht to work in a Rolls Royce on a congressman's salary.
Well, I know, but I think that he may not be the only one doing this. And there was an interesting point made. Someone was saying, for example, how Tom DeLay in Washington, lives sort of frugally, which is sort of hard to imagine considering all the lavish trips he's taken. And then someone, for example, Rick Santorum also lives rather frugally. But the point is, For Cunningham, it was about himself, but for a lot of these guys, it's not about them. It's about amassing power, and the easiest way for them to amass more and more power is to get plugged in with these lobbyists who can give them unlimited favors, you know, unlimited money, and, you know, seemingly, you know, pull unlimited strings for them. And what we saw in terms of Abramoff, over and over again, he would boast about his connections to Tom DeLay. He would say, you know, and then he would say in emails, for example, you know, Tom's on this, for example, things like that. So, you know, it was a very, very important relationship, you know, for Jack Abramoff to have with Tom DeLay.
And what about the DeLay's real friends? I mean, everybody knows that DeLay's been the real power broker in the Republican House, and Hastert, in effect, is his protege, although he's got the more senior job. And then when DeLay was indicted by Ronnie Earl down in Texas, he handed over the reins to Roy Blunt. And Hastert, of course, was the biggest recipient of Abramoff's money. So what are both Hastert and Blunt vulnerable?
Well, I don't know if Hastert, how implicated he is in the Abramoff scandal. He was given quite a bit of money from Abramoff and did write a letter to the Department of Interior shortly after Abramoff held a fundraiser for him. So they may be looking at him. His name hasn't come up all that much, though, in terms of someone who did favors akin to what Bob Ney did. I think, though, you know, politically at least, Hastert is probably safe, but the Republicans have to ask themselves, is it the problem just Tom DeLay, or is the problem the entire Republican leadership? And that's an internal debate that's going to be had very soon. You have to realize Congress is not in session right now and won't be in session until January 31st because of Tom DeLay. The Republican leadership basically decided, we don't want to hold new leadership elections, so we don't want to be back in power. So what they did is they pushed the recess date all the way back to January 31st, which is the latest date it's ever been since 1933, which is somewhat amazing to think about, because they didn't want to have to deal with this question. Now they had to deal with it, because unfortunately for Tom DeLay, Jack Abramoff cut a deal over the recess. So I think you're going to see people start talking about, do we get rid of DeLay, or do we get rid of, you know, the entire, you know, 3, 4, 5 people that are running the Republican Party right now?
Well, I guess, Ari Berman, my question is more rhetorical, and that is, you know, it's the Teflon factor. I mean, George W. Bush somehow has skated away from the not DeLay scandal, but the Ken Lay scandal early in his presidency, when Ken Lay took Enron down and I think wiped out something like $400 billion of stock value in one of the most egregious corporate scandals in American history. And Ken Lay happened to be George W. Bush's one of his longest friends in politics, his single biggest contributor to George W. Bush's career. And somehow Bush skated and never rubbed off on him. So I'm wondering whether, you know, Tom DeLay's cronies are going to skate.
Maybe. I think there was an impression that wasn't necessarily an accurate one, that Enron was sort of an equal opportunity scandal, as you referred to earlier, with whether Abramoff would be that way. I think Abramoff is a distinctly Republican scandal. I think that Abramoff was a movement conservative. He was a conservative way back in the days when he was a college Republican, along with Grover Norquist and a bunch of other people, Ralph Reed, Karl Rove. And what you see is that this is exactly, Abramoff was sort of a personification of the K Street strategy. The sort of crack in Washington right now is that Democrats have no power to abuse. It was the Republicans that were in control. So I think in that sense, you know, Abramoff is a distinctly Republican scandal. And what you're going to see is a Justice Department investigation that could lead in a lot of places. And if there is no political pressure inserted on the Justice Department, you know, it's really outside of the Republicans' control what happens here.
And Ari Berman, how do you explain the fact that it is the George W. Bush's Justice Department that is bringing all of this to light? And, clearly it's damaging to the very core of the movement conservatives that swept Bush into power. As you mentioned, and we should talk more about it, the connections to Grover Norquist and Ralph Reed.
But well, you have to remember it was also the Bush's Justice Department that did, in fact, indict Spiro Libby. But what you have here is you have the Public Integrity Unit of the Justice Department looking at this case, and they have a pretty stellar record when it comes to, you know, being fairly, you know, career employees, nonpartisan in nature. And at some point, you know, maybe it will come out that there was political influence exerted, but I think that they're on real slippery slope, especially since the news has come out that, you know, the Bush administration did overrule senior staff at the Justice Department in a redistricting case involving Tom DeLay in Texas. That was a very bad leak that came out against them, and that now it's going to the Supreme Court, of course. So I think people think right now they've been able to operate with a good deal of credibility. We'll see going forward if that still exists.
But I guess the other question would be then, was the corruption so egregious? I mean, in other words, Washington tolerates a certain level of corruption, but it does seem that this was a quantum leap above business as usual with these fast revolving doors and all this cash and carry politics. Was it just too obvious that they had to move on it?
Oh, absolutely. I think it was all summed up by that amazing photo of Jack Abramoff walking out of the federal courtroom wearing a black fedora and a too-tight black trench coat, which basically showed that, you know, this is a mob-like figure who is so colorful in nature. It wasn't just, you know, the typical Washington, you know, corruption scandal with a bunch of people that aren't very compelling. I mean, what happened, how this started, was the Washington Post published a report about all the money that Indian tribes had given to Abramoff and to Michael Scanlon. That prompted John McCain to launch an Indian Affairs Committee. And once the Indian Affairs Committee started looking at all these emails that Abramoff sent to people where he called Indian tribes troglodytes, where he said phrases like, "I'd love to get my mitts on that mullah," things like that, it just sort of spun out of control. And you realize you were dealing with a rather extraordinary person. And at that point, I think the Justice Department had to act. And what's happening now is more and more people are cutting deals. So Scanlon cuts a deal first. Then Abramoff decides he's going to cut a deal. Apparently, Tony Rudy, the ex-chief of staff to Tom DeLay, is about to cut a deal, which obviously isn't going to be good for DeLay. So more and more people are cutting deals in the same way you see Duke Cunningham deciding to wear a wire. You know, what's happening is the Justice Department's getting a lot of help. They obviously have a lot of goods and a lot of people. And if more and more people roll, it's going to create momentum, I think, where you're going to see, you know, regardless of what the Bush administration wants to do, there's going to be indictments coming down.
And you mentioned, Ari Berman, you mentioned the mob-like image of Abramoff on the courthouse steps. Talk about mob-like image. I mean, there's mob-like activity in this story with the assassination of the Greek owner of the Sun Cruise casinos that Abramoff and Kadan were muscling in on. What's happening with that?
Because absolutely. Well, Abramoff just decided to plead guilty down there, too. This is a complicated investigation because there's two different cases. There's the Indian casino case, which we've been talking about, and then there was the Florida casino case. And Bob Ney is involved in both of them, actually, which is what puts him in so much trouble. But basically, Abramoff wanted to buy this casino company called Sun Cruise down in Florida. Needed help in buying it from this guy, Gus Boulis. And he ended up getting Bob Ney to insert these statements in the Congressional Record disparaging Sun Cruise. And then once Abramoff and his business partner, Adam Kidan, had bought the company, praising it. But what happened was it was a very shady deal. Abramoff was indicted for mail and wire fraud, for basically paying with a bad check to finance it. And then what happened was Gus Boulis ended up being killed in a gangland-style hit a few years ago in 2001, shortly after Abramoff had acquired the company. And it turned out that three of the people that pled guilty to the murder charge, or two of the people named, I think, in the murder charge, at least one of them was paid $300,000 in quote-unquote catering fees by Adam Kidan. So it's an extremely sleazy scandal down there, and that's only one small part of it. That scandal is unique in that it doesn't really represent so much the influence peddling in Washington as the Indian casino one does, but it's certainly as shady, if not worse.
Well, murder is a little more serious than stealing.
Well, absolutely. But it doesn't revolve, for example, it doesn't involve the sort of K Street connection as much as the Indian casino one does, although, of course, you know, murder, as you know, is the most serious charge you can have.
And what's happening with Gail Norton, given that her former counsel is also tied up in the Abramoff scandal?
Yeah, Steve Grouse. It's his former deputy. It's her former deputy.
Sorry, yes.
Norton seems to have escaped for now. I don't know how much trouble she will be in, but Steve Grouse is in a whole bunch of trouble. He was recently, a while ago, he was asked to testify before McCain's committee, and McCain was asking him all these questions about, you know, these emails he had sent to Abramoff over and over, the fact that he considered, while he was working at the Department of Interior, joining Abramoff's law firm, his lobbying firm. And basically, Grouse was saying, I had no notice, I didn't know what was going on, basically, you know, pleading ignorant. And the chief counsel for the Department of Interior basically said, you know, Grouse is lying. I was in these meetings, and he was trying very hard, you know, to grease the wheels for Abramoff's clients and was interested, you know, in meeting with Abramoff himself and maybe taking a job with him. So I think that Grouse will be in trouble, too.
But Ari Berman, just in a broader sense, though, what does this say about the Republican Party? This is no longer the party of the Chamber of Commerce, the Lions Club, the Kiwanis, the small businessmen. This is does the activities of DeLay and Abramoff indicate that this is the Republican Party of big business. This is the Republican Party of bottom feeders. I mean, the stuff that DeLay was involved in, for example, lobbying on behalf of those payday loan companies that set up shop outside military bases to bleed our young service people, charging them up to 400% interest. This is the kind of sleaze that DeLay has not just represented, but he's advocated. He's been their chief lobbyist.
Well,
and the same with those crooks in the Marianas, who were both running sweatshops and female sex slaves.
Absolutely. I think that this is the most compelling case you've seen yet for why we need to get money out of politics. Not just pass, you know, a lobbying reform bill, and everyone in Washington seems to have overnight become a reformer, but this idea that we need to get money from big business out completely of politics. Because what you're seeing is these guys used money to enforce discipline. Tom DeLay didn't care who the recipient was. He needed money so that he could keep his troops in line. Remember that the way that the system works in terms of being a committee chairman now in the Republican Party is you need to raise X money. If you don't raise X money, you can't be the head of a committee. And then, of course, it follows that if you don't, you know, take part in all the sort of, I guess you could say, all the different activities that DeLay needs from you, you can't be a committee chairman either. So, of course, if you vote in a certain way that they don't like, you can't rise to power anyway. So you have to be incredibly disciplined, and you basically have to submit to the party leadership, but you also have to be very adept at constantly raising money. And you constantly need to find different ways of raising money, especially as campaign finance laws have changed. And they found that K Street and all these other shady characters have been the most convenient way of A, giving them money, and B, you know, giving them pull to keep their troops in line.
So just in closing, Ari Berman, I understand that the lobbying business is about a $2 billion business in Washington, D.C., and then and how does that compare to the total of that goes into campaign financing? So it's as though the politicians are double dipping. They raise money for campaigns, which compromises them, but lobbyists also spend lavishly on them.
Well, what happens is lobbyists give them a lot of money. For example, Jack Abramoff was a Bush pioneer. He raised $100,000 for the Bush campaign in 2004. So they obviously have financial clout, but they also have clout in terms of they can open doors with business. So, for example, a big part of the Republican strategy is getting big business to help them pass legislation and sometimes even write it. And lobbyists come in handy there because they're the conduit to that. So you see that lobbyists are more and more almost like another branch of government. They're involved in writing legislation. They're involved in raising campaign contributions. They're involved in lining up other campaign contributors. And especially at these GOP-only firms, there's more and more of them. One of the biggest has been Alexander Strategy Group that's been implicated in the scandals involving Tom DeLay and the scandals involving Abramoff and in the scandal involving Duke Cunningham, all three simultaneously. You see that they are essentially, you know, a non-government branch of the Republican Party. So I think that's what you see here is the bigger picture, is how K Street was fused with the Republican Party and where it got, you know, Americans, where, you know, the average American has zero, absolutely zero stake in anything that Tom DeLay is doing right now.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles, Ari Berman.
Thank you, Ian.
Bye-bye. Hello again. I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking then with Ari Berman, who's a contributing writer to The Nation magazine. He is the Nation Institute's Puffin Foundation Writing Fellow, and he's been covering the deepening Abramoff-DeLay scandal for The Nation magazine. I'm now speaking with Dr. Craig Holman, who's a legislative representative for Public Citizen, serving as the organization's Capitol Hill lobbyist on campaign finance and government ethics. Dr. Holman's assisted in drafting campaign finance reform legislation, has conducted numerous research projects on the initiative process and the impact of money in politics. So, Dr. Coleman, I take it that you believe that it's the defective structure of the system in American politics that enables corruption.
Hello, Ian. Yes, I'm glad to be on the show, by the way. We need not be distracted by the confessions and the eventual penalty that Jack Abramoff is going to get for his crimes. Jack Abramoff is a crook, but let's not take any comfort in the fact that he'll be sentenced perhaps to 9.5 or 10 years in prison, because the problem really is systemic. We have a culture out here on Capitol Hill where money just means everything, and it's not only the lifeblood for office holders who get for office holders for their elections, but it's also used by lobbyists to shower gifts upon office holders, to take them on travel to luxurious resorts and golf outings in Scotland, and even it's used in an indirect way of promises of lucrative employment for jobs for members of Congress or congressional staff once they leave public service.
Well, to tell me, though, we were talking earlier about the figures. The lobbying world is a $2 billion a year industry. And what's the campaign finance world in terms of total money that goes into the Congress, the House, and the President?
They're roughly about equivalent. It's $2.1 billion that was spent on lobbying in 2004, and that's a 25% jump over just 5 years earlier. In campaigns, it's much more difficult to actually come up with a concrete figure. But if you include all federal elections across the board, and including the presidential, senatorial over a six-year period, congressional, we're also talking in the category of roughly about $2 billion.
So you got to pay the politicians, you got to give the politicians money to get them elected, and then when they're elected, the lobbyists give them money to grease the wheels to get the legislation passed.
Yeah, money is the source of the problem here. We will never really clean up Washington until we get special interest dollars out of politics, particularly out of elections. Public financing, 100% full public financing, is the real solution for trying to bring some sense of integrity back to Capitol Hill and the White House. But in the meantime, that isn't really on the nation's agenda at this point. At this point, Congress is starting to take a very serious look at reforming lobbying practices here on Capitol Hill. How far they're going to go in these reforming the lobby laws is yet to be seen. But at least Congress is willing to move in that direction.
Well, I'm not sure they're willing. I think they're being forced to by such blatant scandals that they simply can't duck this bullet. Now, I guess the core question then is, Dr. Holman, is you're saying that public financing is the answer, and of course the only way we'll get public financing is if the public is upset enough to force it through. Clearly, the point about having money in politics is that if money is the means by which you get things done, then the system automatically favors the rich. So obviously the wealthy and the connected want money to be the mother's milk of politics.
Yes, and public financing is the answer. It is the only way to get special interests influence in check. However, I said earlier, it really isn't on the nation's political agenda to set up a full public financing system for Congress, but that doesn't mean we're not going to keep calling for it. You know, as a matter of fact, Public Citizen has long been advocating that. We will continue to advocate it. We're having more success working with other groups like Public Campaign at the state level and implementing full public financing around the states. Once that can is spread around to enough state and local jurisdictions and have a demonstrated track record of actually working, then it may come on the nation's political agenda for the federal government as well. In the meantime, by the way, I've been working hard for lobby reform for the last 2 years out here in Capitol Hill. These corruption scandals have now put us front and center on the agenda. But for the last 2 years, you know, I've been working with some reformers in Congress who are sincere about reform, like Representative Marty Meehan from Massachusetts or Senator Russ Feingold from Wisconsin. And they've introduced lobbying reform bills each year over the last couple of years, and they've never gone anywhere. They haven't even been able to have a hearing conducted on this legislation. Well, just as of last week, with the last breaking news of Abramoff now confessing to conspiracy to attempt to bribe office holders and his subsequent willingness to work with the Department of Justice and pointing fingers at lawmakers, just about every lawmaker and the grandmother is now willing to sign on to these lobby reform bills. So we're going to see something happen.
But just in general, to try and get the public connected to their government, which they clearly aren't, and the less connected they are, the more corrupt it becomes. So to some extent, you get the government you deserve. But just in terms of pure mechanics, what seems to happen, and I guess that's why the term lobbyist is used, is because these are the people that are in the congressional lobby, just in the ante room, as you will, off the floor, and they intercept the traffic and control the flow and keep the public out. Now, you are yourself a lobbyist, but you're a lobbyist on the part of the citizens as opposed to the powerful and connected. And of course, what we learn through this scandal, and it's been we should have known about this forever, is that there's a revolving door in Washington that even though most congressmen have tenure, academics would envy, they occasionally get bumped off, and they immediately then become lobbyists. So.
Yeah, this revolving door is a very serious problem on Capitol Hill. It's one of the most effective resources that special interest groups and lobbyists can use to buy influence on Capitol Hill. What it consists of is sitting down with either congressional staff members or members of Congress while they're working on legislation of interest to you, and basically offering them a very lucrative job in the private sector as a K Street lobbyist upon their retirement. We now see some members of Congress who have left public service, such as Representative Billy Tozen, immediately taking a $2 million job as the head lobbyist for the pharmaceutical industry. And now he took that job within 2 months after he helped draft and promote and pass the prescription drug bill that provides for no price controls on drugs. It was everything the pharmaceutical industry asked for. It prohibits the federal government from importing cheaper drugs from Canada. It prohibits the federal government from using its market power to leverage lower prices from the drug companies. And within 2 months after passing that bill, then Billy Tolzan's offered a $2 million job that he took with the pharmaceutical industry. Not only that, by the way, there were more than a dozen members in the White House administration who also just spun through that revolving door, taking jobs with the pharmaceutical industry right after they passed the prescription drug bill. It was a windfall, not just for the pharmaceutical industry, but also for public officials who worked on the bill.
But Dr. Holman, how does an average citizen? Let's take somebody that's retired and that's finding themselves being bankrupted by medical and prescription drug costs, and is wondering whether they should take a bus to Canada. And apart from the AARP, what can they do compared to Billy Tolzan? In other words, can we construct a system where lobbyists' power and influence should be somehow graduated on the basis of how many people they represent? In other words, if you represent 10,000 regular people, you should have more access than the lobbyist who represents 2 or 3 billionaires.
That's an interesting reform proposal. I haven't heard that being discussed.
No, I just made it up.
Some of the more reform proposals that we are seeing here on the Hill, one is being promoted by Senator Russ Feingold. That is the best bill that I've yet seen when it comes to lobbying reform. And that would impose a 2-year ban on any retiring public official, any former member of Congress, from not only picking up the telephone and contacting their former colleagues, but from doing any lobbying activity for payment. So after they were to leave Congress for 2 years, they couldn't become a lobbyist. That's one very sweeping reform. The alternative legislation that appears to be having more feet than the Feingold legislation is something that's being offered by Senator John McCain, which is a good bill too, but it's, you know, for the most part, it's just a disclosure bill. It's not nearly as strong as the Feingold bill. It would extend the revolving door prohibition to 2 years, but apply it only to making lobbying contacts. We have this ridiculous law on the books right now, in which a former member of Congress who leaves the public sector and becomes a lobbyist can do so immediately upon leaving the public sector, but the one thing they can't do is actually pick up the telephone and call their former colleagues for 1 year. That's the extent of our revolving door restriction. It's so weak and so ineffectual at preventing the horse trading that goes on between lobbyists and members of Congress that literally 43% of all members of Congress who retire for reasons other than death or conviction become K Street lobbyists now.
43%?
43%, almost half of the members of Congress, once they leave, they become a lobbyist.
Well, I have another suggestion for you. Why don't we get the force the lobbyists to, instead of wearing business suits and their Gucci loafers, tasseled loafers, as one person described them, and you should read some of the early writings of the Republic where they refer to these people as reptiles, but without getting too florid here. How about instead of wearing business suits, you dress the lobbyists like race car drivers, you know, that have patches all over their race cars, you know, saying Pennzoil and whoever sponsors them, that they just show up, you know, like people holding up a sign at an airport with all their logos from which corporation they represent?
I'm trying to imagine what that would mean I would have to wear.
Well, yeah, let's draw a distinction between what you do and what they do, because obviously, you know, there is some sense to having lobbying, in other words, because clearly the public in this country, for reasons that mystify me, just aren't that involved in politics. So somebody has to do the dirty work. So give me a sense of what kind of a lobbyist you are and what kind of lobbyist you want to clean up.
Sure. Lobbying is a useful activity and in fact, perhaps a necessary activity in many regards. What I do, for instance, I mean, where the good lobbying is when a person who has a certain amount of expertise in a field goes to members of Congress and congressional staff and educates them about the field and, you know, tells them, explains what we think are the problems and potential solutions. That's the good, useful role for lobbying activity. Where lobbying becomes corrupt is where the money gets involved. Once you start having lobbyists serving as treasurers on office holders' political action committees, making campaign contributions, organizing fundraisers, paying for luxurious travel, that's when we cross the line away from an educational, useful function and start making money more important than any expertise any of us may have. That's what we're seeing going on here on the Hill now. By the way, I want to point out some of the key features of Feingold's bill.
Well, we got 30 seconds because we're running out of time here.
Feingold's bill not only would shut down the revolving door, it would also prohibit lobbyists from going along on any of these travel junkets. If a lobbyist can't go play golf with Tom DeLay in Scotland, you know, odds are they're just not going to set up one of these junkets. And the Feingold bill would also ban all gifts from lobbyists to members of Congress, applying the no cup of coffee rule. These are all very sweeping changes. One change that I would like to see done, which is in California, is a prohibition against lobbyists making campaign contributions or arranging fundraisers. It's just nonsensical to me that we allow people who are negotiating some sort of legislative favors from office holders at the same time hand them a wad of cash for their campaign contributions. That's just an absurd system. We've got to break that nexus between money, lobbyists, and office holders.
I thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles, Dr. Craig Holman.
It was a pleasure.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters, and I was just talking with Dr. Craig Holman, who's a legislative representative for Public Citizen in Washington, D.C. I thank Lewis Vandenberg, the producer, Jazz Shepard, the engineer, Rusty Wynn, the associate producer, and Carol Coote, the assistant producer.